This is Joe McMillan. It's November 11, 1994, and we are interviewing with Mr. Elmer Clark, longtime horse trainer, horse patron, ex-school teacher, and friend from Lexington, Kentucky. Why don't we start out with a little bit of your personal history. When and where were you born?
In Louisville, October 6, 1929. I was born in Louisville, but moved to Lexington with my grandparent about a month. My father was riding races at Churchill in the fall when I was born in 1929. And that was October. I was born October the 6th. Whatever the meeting was, how long it lasted during that time, I don't remember, but I know he was here riding races, and my mother was with him at that time.
Mm-hmm. And your name is Elmer Clark. Was your father
Elmer Stone Clark Jr.?
And your father's name was Elmer Clark also?
Elmer Stone Clark.
All right.
And while we're mentioning that, my father was the first black jockey to ever receive a license to ride in the state of Florida. But once they found out that he was black, my father was very fair-skinned. And once they found out he was black, they denied him that privilege of riding in Florida. But he had been licensed to ride in Florida.
But at the time you were born, he was an exercise boy?
No, he was still riding.
He was still riding.
Yeah. My father was only 18 when I was born. My mother and father both were 18 years old at that time.
So he did have a license to ride here in Kentucky at the time.
Oh, yeah, he was riding here.
He was riding.
Yeah. In fact, in 1927 or somewhere like that, I forgot what year he told me, when Aurora Downs first opened up, he won the very first race at Aurora Downs Racetrack, which is in Illinois.
Right.
And I was born at that time.
Do you have any brothers and sisters?
No, I'm the only child.
You're the only child. That's very interesting. Were any of your other family members, other than your father, involved in horse racing?
Everybody, just about. My father had a twin brother, but he was much bigger than my father, taller, heavier, and everything. He was a groom for many, many years on the racetrack.
And then what was his name, Mr. Clark?
Henry Clark.
Okay.
Right. Their mother died at childbirth. My father was the oldest, and then when Henry was born, I forgot now what they said, how many hours afterwards, she died in labor. And that's on my father's side, and on my mother's side, my uncles and my grandfather on that side were in the horse business.
Were they from Louisville or from Lexington?
Lexington.
They were from Lexington.
Yeah. They were from in Lexington and around Lexington.
Right. Your father really was from Lexington.
He was born in Lexington. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You just happened to be born in Louisville because he was on the racetrack.
Because he was riding races in Louisville that fall.
I see. You have a nickname?
No, not growing up, did anybody give you any nickname? When I was growing up, my grandfather, my mother's father, went to see a movie once. I don't remember the name of the movie, but I knew they talked about it. And there was a little boy in there that they called Chinkapin. And when I was growing up, they used to call me Chinkapin, and then it was shortened to Chink. And I was called Chink up until maybe early high school, or just before I went in high school. But all the people in the neighborhood called me Chink. It wasn't a universal type nickname. Nobody else really knew. Didn't follow you on high school or college or anything.
Yeah, have you ever been married?
Oh, yeah.
Are you married now?
Married, have two children, been married for 37 years.
And how old are your children? Are they grown?
My daughter is 30. She's the youngest. And my son is 35. He works at the University of Tennessee in Nashville. And he's a counselor and admission officer there. He works in records and admission.
What is his name?
Gregory Anthony Clark. And It's a Kappa, by the way. I'm non-Greek.
Yeah. Are they involved in racing at all?
Nobody else in my family. My son is. I used to have him with me on the racetrack. I taught him everything that was possible. And at one time, he was hired as the outrider at Balmoral. And just before the meeting came about, he had to leave, and he did not really work as an outrider, but he was programmed to work as an outrider.
Now, I need to talk about your grandparents, and your maternal and your paternal grandparents. Mm-hmm. Do you remember them?
My mother's, I do. But my father's mother died at childbirth, and my father's father was killed at the age when, I think my father was about 10 mm-hmm. when he was killed. So no, I don't remember them, but I remember all on my mother's side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how far back do you go on your mother's side?
I can remember my great-grandmother, because she died when I was maybe, I was in elementary school, but I don't remember what, you know, maybe preschool.
Was she a Lexingtonian also?
I don't know that.
But they lived in and around Lexington.
In Lexington, yeah.
I see. All right. How important was school to your family?
That's a very good question. It's a difficult question to answer because my great-grandmother was born in slavery. And my grandmother and grandparent were right out of that, so they didn't have much schooling. And the only person was my mother, and she was in her second year of college at Kentucky State when she got pregnant with me. And she did not go back to school. And her sisters and brothers, none of them went off to college. And I think only one of her, so she had two other sisters, and only one of them graduated from high school. I think the other one quit in like the 10th or 11th grade or somewhere.
Let's talk a little bit about thoroughbred racing. What are your first memories of thoroughbred racing?
4 years old. I was 4 years old. And my father was working for Jack Howitt at that time. My father and Ivan Parks and all of them rode races together, okay? And Jack Howitt, at some point or the other, made a lot of money and bought a farm. And my father was still working for him and riding races for him and doing various things for him. And as I said, I was 4 years old when I first remember that. That was my first recollection of the horses and stuff. And I guess
you've been with them ever since. You can still recall that.
Yeah. Very well. We were at the farm. I can remember being at the farm, at Jack Howitt's farm. I don't know the name of the farm, but I had a name. Yes. Uh-huh. And it seemed as if this one recollection I have, seemed as if there was a picnic or something at the farm, because I can remember it looked like they had big beer kegs, and one of the spigots were dripping, and I laid under the spigot and I caught some beer and I got stoned out of my mind and whipped.
Got stoned and whipped at the same time.
All at the same time for doing this. But I remember that just as plain as anything, laying under the spigot.
And then after your that experience that you can recall, when was it that you started getting to be around racehorses regularly?
The rest of my life.
The rest of my life,
because I lived on Chester Street.
Did you continue to work on the track?
No. My father left the racetrack very early after he stopped riding. He somehow or the other, he became very closely associated with the Fontaine family, as with Jack Fontaine, who trained Needles, that won the Kentucky Derby. Yeah. And Mrs. Fontaine helped to set my father up in business. So financially, he had a limousine service in New York out on Garden City, Nassau Boulevard. And at that time, you could buy spots at the train station they would sell spots at the train station to limousine people. And he bought one spot, and that was through Mrs. Fontaine, and then he made enough money to buy him two other spots. So he had three limousines working day and night at the out on Nassau. He had a lot of big clients. Eddie F. Carroll was one of his clients. Trotter, who was the racing secretary and handicapper. And the most recent was Susan Lucci before my father died, were some of his clients.
So your father moved to New York then, right?
He moved to New York like in just before World War II started. Because he went to work in a factory. He tried to get in the Army, and he couldn't get in the Army because he had gotten injured and he had a plate in his head, okay? And they wouldn't take him into the Army. So then he went to work in a factory for a short length of time, and then the plate was causing some kind of damage, I don't know, and he had to leave there.
So then he went into the limousine business.
First he went into, he was had a, like a, what you call it, a you know, when people wasn't selling papers and stuff, he was, well, you know, these guys who, he was subcontracting papers and had people about, you know, sending people out with the daily paper and stuff. And then right after that, he threw Mrs. Fontaine, and with Mrs. Fontaine, he got the limousine service because she let him have some money.
So where did you spend your pubescent and adolescent ages?
Grew up in Lexington, went to Constitution Elementary School and Dunbar High School in Lexington. Played sports there, football and basketball. That's all we had. We ran track, but it wasn't that much of a track out there. And enjoyed some memorable moments against Central High School in Louisville, Kentucky.
My old high school.
The old high school. And then from there,
went to Dunbar. Right,
right.
Yeah.
And then
that time, were you working on the track
the summer months?
What would you be doing? What kind of work?
Well, at first I was learning how to gallop horses, and that was my main interest until I started to play sports. And then I wanted to play, and I left that galloping horses alone. And then I started rubbing horses during the summer, trying to gain as much weight as I possibly could.
So you could play some football.
So that I could play football. Yeah. My first year, as I said, of playing football, I weighed 128 pounds with helmet all the way down to the shoes. Show you how big I was.
So you fell into the normal sports things that boys at that time were falling into, basketball, football.
Right,
that kind of
right,
thing.
Right.
And so horse racing sort of became secondary, right?
It did. And galloping horses, really, that was the number one priority at one time, until sports became involved. After sports act became involved in sports, that became the dominant and prevalent thing. Athletics.
Right.
And so then I stayed with horses all the rest of the time. Every summer, I would work with horses. I never left the racetrack. I stayed with them, but I still went to school.
So would the working on the track be like a summer job then for you?
Every summer. Even I quit school a couple of times to go to work on the racetrack almost on a yearly basis. But I would end up getting back to school and leaving the racetrack alone. But I stayed there always during the summer.
When did you graduate from Lexington Dunbar High School?
January of 1948.
And then when you graduated from high school, you went on to college from there?
No.
Interim period.
No. And when I graduated from high school in January of 48, I went to Dayton, Ohio for about a month. Then I went back to the racetrack, and I went to work for Calumet and Ben Jones at the time. And that's the year that we had Citation, Cold Town, and Bewitch and all those horses. And I was rubbing a horse that was a two-year-old at that time named Ponder, who won the Kentucky Derby the next year.
1949.
Right, right. Okay. So in 48, I was there with them, and I was the paddock man for Citation the day he won the Kentucky Derby.
So you were young then.
I was
1948, right out of high school, right?
Yeah, 17 going on 18.
Citation won the Derby in 1948.
48, right.
Cold Town was second in
that Derby. Second, and ran one, too. Right.
And at that time, you were right there.
I was the paddock man at the Saturday 12th of Citation of Dade Wonder Derby. One of the greatest thrills of my life occurred, and I have not, as of yet, equaled that moment of personal thrill as I did, as happened to me then. We were going down the, I don't know, you remember how you come out of the backside at the gap at Churchill and you make right. that bend all the way down from the 3-8 pole, I mean the 7-8 pole going to the paddock? I was walking along beside Citation. We were in front and Cold Town was behind. And the people there started to ask, what horse is that? What horse is that? They kept asking and asking. So finally I said, this is Citation, that's Cold Town. And like wildfire, people said, Citation is coming, and they just ran to the fence. I mean, it just, in groves, they ran to the fence, and the word was going along in front. Citation is coming, I had cold chills that I, and bumps that have never occurred since then. And I've had a lot of great moments in personal sports, as well as coaching and so on, but nothing has ever equaled that thrill.
Just the walking over there.
Yeah, and hearing those fans, just hearing the people.
Oh, here comes Citation.
Citation is coming and seeing them running to the fence and the word spreading in front of them.
Yeah, I can remember that derby very well. Yeah. Citation had won the derby trial that same week and then came back to win the derby. Cold Town opened up a long lead in that race.
Well, see, at that, like, I can tell you exactly what happened at that. We were in the paddock and Eddie Alcaro rode Citation, and Newbolt Pearson, Leroy, rode Cold Town. And Ben Jones told them in the paddock, he said, I think Citation is the best horse and I want him to win the Derby. He said, but if he can't, Leroy, you go ahead and win it. There was never any doubt in his mind that he didn't have the best two horses there. And he said, and don't forget, whoever wins, however we do it, we're still going to split this purse. You got to split your purse with Snyder's Widder. Well, a boy named Snyder was riding Citation all the time. And he got, he was drowned and lost in Florida in the Everglades just before they came east that winter. And he was supposed to have been on Citation because he was Citation's regular rider. And Ben told him that they had to split that money with Snyder's Widder, and which was no problem with them. Mm-hmm. So then when Cold Town opened up, see, Cold Town was a free running horse. You didn't have to hit it. All you had to do was just reach and grab him. Just keep changing holes and reaching for him. And as Leroy did this, he made this long open lead, and when Citation came out of the pack at the quarter pole and went by him, Leroy just sat still. And all he did was just kept looking back to see if anybody else was coming. Because if he had just reached and grabbed him a couple more times, Citation may have won, but it would have been in a photo or something like that.
Right. But where it was, he won by a big margin.
Ben wanted Citation to win. And he went on to prove that he was the best horse in the world at that point as a 3-year-old.
So then after high school, you just went on with Calumet for a while. How long did you stay
with him? I was with Calumet until June, and I told I'll refer to him as B.A., Mr. Jones, that I wanted to try out. Kentucky State at that time had summer tryout camps for football players, and I guess most black schools did. I can't really say, but Kentucky State did. And we were still here in Louisville, because we were waiting on the barn to get built at Washington Park in Chicago. And I told B.A. that I wanted to try to see if I could play college football. And he said, well, you go ahead. And when, if you make it, fine. If you don't, you always got your job here. You can come back. So when I got ready to go to the school, Dr. Hardheel carried me to the bus station with all my bags and stuff, put me on the bus. Ben Jones gave me, it was either $50 or $100 or something to put into my pocket to take off with me to school. And I left, went off to college, tried out, got a scholarship, and the rest of it was history.
And then you went on to college and went to Kentucky State, right?
Went to Kentucky State.
And then stayed
got
there
a scholarship 4 years. Year.
4 years at Kentucky State.
In between Army and stuff, because I went to Kentucky State. 1948 to 1949 was my freshman year, and then I did not go back to Kentucky State anymore until 1953. I had been in the service and been on the racetrack again, and because during that time after I got out the Army, I somewhere on the, during that time I broke a counterpoint for C.B. Whitney, who ended up being Horse of the Year in 51 or 2 or something. I forgot what year that was.
Well, you've had lots of experience and back and forth on the racetrack.
Right.
What other kinds of who were some of the other people that you worked for other than Ben Jones?
Oh, I worked for Hal Price Heagley. I worked for Main Chance. I worked for C.B. Whitney. I never really worked for nobody but the big outfits. I never did work for any of the small outfits.
Were you always a groom or an exercise horse?
I exercised some. I exercised horses with one of the best black jocks they had around here. It was Jimmy Blackbird,
who
rode races in Louisville. Yeah. And he and I and Jimmy Fox were together. Jimmy Fox, another race rider. But as I said,
these were black jockeys,
right. I stopped because I got interested in sports, and I was going to school, and I wanted to play. And so that ended my riding career very shortly and abruptly.
I see. Tell me something about African Americans in the horse racing business at that particular time. Did you meet any blacks who were jockeys? Did you mention Blackburn and Fox? How prominent were blacks in horse racing?
There were some very outstanding black trainers during that time. One of them lived here, Henry Loudon, which was probably the best black horseman that was around in the United States at that time. Henry Loudon was a very astute horseman, and kept a barnload of horses at Churchill and would come to Chicago with these horses. Then there was...
Henry had a brother, too, didn't he?
Who helped rear my father. That was Ernest.
Right.
Ernest reared my father just about when he came onto the racetrack. But the difference between the two of them, Ernest and Henry, Ernest never wanted responsibility, a lot of responsibility, so he only kept like 3 or 4 horses all the time. Whereby Henry kept 25, 30 head of horses all the time. But Ernest never wanted. I could not at that time, because I was so young, I was a teenager, I could not evaluate their real worth against each other. But they were both very astute horsemen.
Yeah.
Okay?
And who was on the other one?
Then that was Carl Sitgraves, who was here. But another one who was outstanding and made his mark, though, was Mr. Taz. We call him Taz.
Taz Perosia,
who was
right.
training for Brown Hotel.
Right,
he was training for Brown Hotel at that time. And even though Ben Jones and Calumet Farm, like in 47, 48, had all those stake horses, Mr. Taz was the leading trainer at Washington Park one of those years. And he was outstanding.
And well respected, too.
Right, outstanding. He had to be. I mean, he had all those horses for
the Brown Hotel.
Joe was at James
Brown. Brown.
Yeah.
Right.
He was outstanding. And then there were the little guys that were around, like Theophilus Urban, Perry Smith, and some of the others. Then the outstanding old ex-riders that were around when I was coming up, like Pick Dishman and Speck, I forgot his name. But it still was 5 or 6 around. And then in my early part, probably one of the greatest horsemen, black horsemen, was... during the turn of the century in the early part, it was Raleigh Colston. And Raleigh died, I guess, before I was 13, 14 years old. But outstanding.
Lexingtonian?
Yes.
In Lexington.
Yeah, Raleigh Colston.
In fact,
and Raleigh did not allow a woman in his shed. He didn't care if they owned the horses or not. If they, if a woman owner came there to see the horses, she had to stand outside the barn, and they would bring the horses out to show them. That, I don't know if that was his superstition or what, but no woman could come in there.
maybe that was his chauvinism, then, right?
I don't know that it was, but you know, I tell you something that I remember some of the older guys telling me that they had asked Sam Hildreth, who was one of the outstanding white trainers of the time, who was one of the who was the second best trainer around, when they asked him that. And he was watching a horse of his work at Belmont Park. And after the horse finished working, he turned to the rider that asked him, of course. He said, I tell you something, Raleigh Colston takes a back seat to no man. So that was a mouthful right there. That lets you know the importance of Raleigh Colston as a horseman during that time.
In other words, even though there was just a few black trainers around, the ones that were around were outstanding. They were well respected by the other horsemen around.
Right.
A person like Ben Jones would respect Cats Perosi.
Not would, did.
Did.
Right. In the highest, held him in the highest esteem because he was, you know, was there. Then later on, Clifford Scott came around and Raymond White came around. I mean, Raymond was around on a different circuit, and then he moved into this area, into the Louisville area, and had a big barn of horses here.
I remember
Perry Smith trained a horse for Rochester that ran at the Kentucky Derby, a horse named Burnt Cork. Was years ago.
1943.
Is that the year it was?
Yes. Yeah. I know that year very well. Yeah.
I didn't remember. But yeah, and I know I played football against his son, Eddie Anderson's son, that when he was at Fort Knox. He played football down at Fort Knox when I was at Kentucky State.
Great history. Now, when you graduated from Kentucky State, what year did you graduate from Kentucky State?
56. I was through, I played football in 55, which was my last year, and then I was really finished with Kentucky State, and I went back and, I did my practice teaching. I had to practice teach in January of 56. So I went to Lexington to Douglas High School, where I did my practice teaching, and while there, saw one of the best high school basketball teams that ever played the game of basketball, and that was Central High of 1956.
That was a team that you that won the
won the state championship. They beat us, Douglas High School, by 26 points in the finals of the state. We were invited to go to the national tournament because St. Elizabeth of Chicago was still involved in the Catholic tournament, and the national tournament needed a team. So they called Lexington Douglas and asked us would we come. And we accepted the invitation on one condition, is that we would not be in the same bracket with Central. And they obliged us, and we went there. Central played through their bracket, we played through our bracket, and met for the championship of the national, for the Black National Tournament. And Central beat us by 23 points.
So they beat you two times.
So we're the second best team in the state, we're the second best team in the nation, and Central is number one all of the time.
So then you took a job then at Douglas after you got out of Kentucky State?
No, after that I left. I went to Franklin, Kentucky that fall and worked in Franklin, Kentucky year.
Simpson County?
Simpson County.
Yeah. Way down near the border. There,
right on the, about 6 miles from the Tennessee border.
In the Franklin school system.
1 year. That's where I met my wife. We got married and went to Chicago on our honeymoon and stayed.
And then in Chicago, did you start teaching or you still kept on working on the track? Or
well, I was still working on the racetrack during all this time because like in 54, I was with Whitney when Fisherman was one of the outstanding three-year-olds in the country at that time. I was there with Whitney and then somewhere during that time, maybe like in 52 or somewhere, I was rubbing gunshot. Gunshot and Jules Reward were the number two big horses in the country for main chance at that time. I was rubbing him as a three-year-old, was even rubbing him when he broke his leg. And so I was still with the racetrack. So the times that I was out of Kentucky State, before I went in the Army, after I got out of the Army, and in between when I went to Kentucky State, back out on the racetrack again. From the time that I first enrolled in Kentucky State until the time that I graduated was over an eight-year period, but I only spent 3.5 years actually in Kentucky State. I had another year of football eligibility left, and
You were still with those horses, right?
Still with the horses.
And is that why they call you Racehorse Clark?
Well, you know, the Racehorse Clark came about with when I was coaching basketball in Chicago. I coached basketball in high school. And one of the other coaches there, a fellow named Lee Umbles, who coached at Harlan High School, used to kid me about being with the horses all the time. And somehow or the other came out Racehorse Clark. So most all the coaches in the city would call me Racehorse Clark, and then some of the other guys, like Howard Amos, picked it up. And so basically the Chicago area, people would refer to me as Racehorse Clark because...
Because you were always with the horses.
Always with the horses.
So then after you, you worked in the Chicago school system for a number of years then.
I worked in the Chicago school system for 30 years. And I just retired a couple of years ago. I coached basketball at Frost South football and baseball at Dunbar, say for over a 10-year period. And it had gotten to the point where, because during that same time, I became the first black paramutual harness horse judge in America. And that job became so taxing that I had to give up coaching because I had to be at the harness track almost at 3 o'clock every day, and I couldn't coach and do that too. And I had to go to the racetrack. We had to go to the racetrack 2 days. The harness races were at night, okay? And the stewards had to go into the racetrack 2 days a week to take care of the draw, the scratches, and so forth. And my days were on Wednesday and Saturday. So on Wednesdays, I even had to leave school like for 3 or 4 hours during my class period. I tried to arrange my classes whereby I would have like off periods or study periods or something during that time where I wouldn't miss a class. But because of the racetrack, because of me working, training my own horses, then going to school, then getting back to the to work at night, it just became too much for me, and I had to give it up. And I couldn't take it
anymore. Tell me about the African American and the horse business. Would you say, in your own estimation, was the best African American jockey that you ever saw?
That I ever saw.
Right.
Oh, there was a guy around New York that could ride, a guy named Skeets Holland. That was outstanding. I'm trying to remember. That was the Flats, and then there was another fellow that rode jumping horses around, and I can't remember his name, and he was always 1, 2, 3 in the standings at Belmont Park and down in Maryland. I can't remember his name right now.
Whatever happened to Holland? Do you remember?
Age.
Is that right?
Age. Because Skeets was still riding. And as an old man in the early 50s, I guess Skeets was probably as old as Earl Sandy. He was in that age group.
He kept riding.
He kept riding. He kept riding around New York, and he was good.
What about outside of New York area? Of course, you mentioned Fox.
They didn't ride too much,
though.
No, but then around New York, we had a boy named Jose Richards. That was outstanding, that rode for Tommy Root. Tommy Root brought him around. Tommy Root also brought Jimmy Long around. But then there were Ronnie Tanner that came around, and then McCurdy. These guys were the leading apprentice boys in New York, where they were like McCurdy and Tanner, was outstanding.
Would this have been in the 50s and 60s?
60s.
In the 60s.
Richard Jose and them was riding for Tony Rutan in the 50s.
I see.
They were riding out that way in the 50s.
Who's the best African-American trainer that you have known? You mentioned Mr. Loudon as one.
He and Taz would probably be
the two best. Guys.
The
Tats,
two
Tats
and but we can't Clifford Scott, you'd have to give him, you have to put him up in that bracket too, because Clifford was in the more in today's era. And
where did Clifford train?
He just died about 3-4 years ago, and he trained up until he died.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And always had a good stable then, right?
Well, he claimed he had a fairly decent stable.
So he trained Hoop Bound.
Yeah, he claimed his horse, as I said, for a little of no money, and then made a stakes winner out of him, and that got him going. He won a couple of $25,000 stake races, which during that time was big money. We're talking about in the 50s. Big money in the 50s.
Who did Clifford Scott train for?
Public training.
Yeah, he was a public training.
Yeah,
a public stable.
Yeah, he had different owners and stuff.
Kept the stable of maybe 15, 20 horses or more?
Or more, all the time. And then he raced exclusively in the Chicago area and New Orleans.
I see.
He would go to New Orleans in the winter and then come back to Chicago and make the whole Chicago circuit until wintertime, then back to New Orleans again.
And he did that during the 60s, on the
70s, 70s, the 80s.
80s.
And he probably went through 91 and 2.
Long term, and he was in the business as long as anybody that you knew.
In fact, Doc Harhill will tell you that was his very first customer, client, when he got out of medical school.
Was he treated differently than the white trainers?
I think all black trainers in some respect are treated different. And it's probably, well, I'll give you an example. When I first got my trainer's license in 1962, I guess it was, there was only two other black trainers in Chicago. That was Clifford Scott and Raymond White. And they didn't give black trainers stalls during that time at Arlington Park. And this is where I first got my license, was at Arlington Park. And it was extremely difficult. Arlington Park was one of the most segregated racetracks in the country at that time. There was a news commentator named Len O'Connell that was on Channel 9. And I wrote Len O'Connell several letters about the segregation that was on the backside. And Len O'Connell came out and looked at it, and he started doing editorials on his news show every night about it. And finally, that type of segregation, like segregated toilets, segregated kitchens and things.
Yeah, right.
Through him, it finally was dissolved. And I feel I had a little something to do with it.
Well,
by first bringing it to his attention and constantly writing letters about it.
That's amazing that would occur in Chicago, which is supposedly north or up south.
That was referred to as the Iron Curtain, by the way.
Is that right?
Right. It was referred to as the Iron Curtain.
The blacks that would go to Arlington Park at that time, they would be separated in terms of facilities.
All facilities on the backside. And not only Arlington, but at Hawthorne, you had the black and white kitchens, your black and white washrooms on the backside. This didn't happen over in the front side, in the clubhouse and the grandstand. Those people were not aware of it. And what was taking place on the backside.
But would this have been, Mr. Clark, in the 50s and 60s?
In the 50s. And into the 60s, too. Went away before the Civil Rights Movement started.
Right. Do you remember Dr. King coming to Illinois?
He spoke at our church. My wife went to see him at Ebenezer, and that Sunday I had something to do and I didn't go to church. And that's one of the things that I regret, that I missed seeing him in person.
and hearing him talk at church that Sunday. But it was due to Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement that I was able to secure the job that I had. As I said, I was the first black paramutual now, because blacks worked at fairs where no money was involved. But I was the first black paramutual judge in America with the honors horses. And it was through the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King that this came about. Because I have a friend named Thurl Addon that's in the rodeo business. He's a rodeo man. And I wrote Sportsman's Park a letter with regards to Thurl and the rodeo business, and to see. So they called me in to find out what I was talking about. And they said, well, they couldn't do it. And I said, well, then you should have some kind of black here as the liaison person there between management and the people, because 68% of Sportsman's Park bettors at that time were black. You know, and they had no blacks at all, nowhere. Ticket tellers are nowhere in the office and no place. So then they started asking me various things over a period of time. So then they brought me in and asked me would I go to work as into the paddock as the equipment manager, which I did. That meant I had to check the equipment on the horses, like the hobbles and all that stuff. And then one thing led into the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. They sent me to school, to the USTA school in Columbus, Ohio.
Well, you made history. You were the first black paramutual judge in the country.
Right.
That's very significant.
Yeah.
What was the best racehorse, thoroughbred, that you remember?
I didn't put them in categories.
With.
Oh, that I worked with.
Yes.
Well, even still, one would always stand out. Citation was the best 3-year-old that ever lived. Okay. I considered, now I didn't work with Count Fleet, but Count Fleet probably was the best 2-year-old that I ever saw. And Kelso has to be the best old horse that I saw. And Twilight Tear, without any question, was the best female horse that I ever saw. Twilight Tear was the first female to ever become horse of the year. So she had to have been the best female horse that I had ever seen. And
well, Twilight Tear beat the colts also.
Right. And in fact, there was a boy that you probably know, Edgar Hamilton.
Yes, sir.
Used to gallop Twilight Tear. And Twilight Tear and Sun Again were the same age. And he used to try to get Ben Jones to put Twilight Tear in the Derby all the time instead of Sun Again. Because every time they worked, Twilight Tear would kick him right dead in the face. Sun Again. But they ran Sun Again in the Derby instead of her. But then she went on to become Horse of the Year.
She won the Oaks, though, didn't she?
She won everything
they
had.
She, yeah. She was just a great filly.
She was outstanding. She was outstanding. And then turned out to be a good brood.
What was her most exciting race? Horse race that you ever saw? I mean, I know that you've seen thousands of them.
I guess when Buck Passer set the world's record at Arlington Park, going a flat mile, because there was a tremendous duel up front going on between Impressive and Heat Jr., and I think the other horse was Whisper Jet, and they had run something like 3/4 mile at 8, half mile at 44, and Buck Passer was sitting back in the pack. No place. And then when they turned down the head of the lane, Bahiza, who rode Buck Passer, swung him out into the middle of the racetrack and just shook the stick at it. And he ran by those horses like they were nailed to the fence.
That the race that Impressive was the rabbit.
Well, he was the stable mate of
Buck
Passer at that time.
And
right.
Impressive went out front with his other fast horse.
Junior.
Yeah,
Heat Jr.
And then Buck Passer, it was set up that way for Buck Passer to come on.
But Buck Passer was so far behind, it just seemed impossible for them, for as fast as they was running, because then when Dr. Fager came along and broke Buck Passer's record, it only broke it by like 1/5 of a second. I think it was 32 and 3.
Or something, right?
It was 32 and 3.
Right.
See, and I had
that's still the record, isn't it?
32 and 2 now.
32 and 2.
Yeah, that Dr. Fager did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because just like a couple of years before that, Calumet had another horse, On and On, and a horse named Intentionally had come in from the West Coast, and they ran a mile over there in like 33-4 or something like that, head to head almost every step of the way. And you thought that was going to be it. And then here comes Buck Pass, and I think that was it. And then the other day in the Breeders' Cup, those fillies, those two Lucas fillies, that was an outstanding race.
Oh, yeah.
That stretch duel that they put on was another outstanding race. I guess
those
two probably just staying out right
Flanders
now.
And Serena Song.
Yeah, whatever her name.
94 Breeders' Cup.
Right. Two-year-olds.
Yeah.
Yeah, two-year-old fillies.
A few more questions, Mr. Clark. You talked about working on the racetrack. Did you work on farms also? Have you ever worked on
horse farms? No, my only experience with the horse farm is when I was with C.B. Whitney, and when we came back from out east, we would go to the farm and lay up during the wintertime. But as far as doing anything else on a farm, I never done anything else on a farm.
If you had to pick out one thing in your career that you were especially proud of in terms of working around horses, what would that be?
Becoming a black steward.
That was it.
That had to be the apex of it, to become the first black steward in America. That would have to become it, without any doubt.
What about family during the time that you were working? Like, you putting down two jobs.
Three jobs, really.
Right.
Because
how did that affect family life?
I was and still fortunate to have the wife that I have, because she was understanding of what I was doing. She still is understanding, because I'm away from home. I've been away from home now for almost 3 years, just going back partially to visit almost. But during that time, during our early years, in fact, I turned down which could have been a very lucrative job for me. Buddy Hirsch and his son, Max Hirsch and his son, Buddy Hirsch, who was training for King Ranch, Max was in New York and Buddy was in Chicago, asked me would I take all of the calls from New York and Chicago, all of the calls that they had, and take them to Ohio to race, because there were some awfully well-bred horses in there, sisters and brothers, some of the outstanding horses that, you know, that was racing for them, like Assault and those horses. And I had to turn it down, because I had only been married like 3 years or something, and I just couldn't stand the idea of leaving home. And I knew my wife wouldn't understand it at that time. And we had, I think, only one child, and I wanted to be there with that one child, so I had to turn that job down. So then from that point on, it was just a matter of me doing the other things that I had to do. I bought my first horse in 62 or 63, I forgot which year it was. And from that time on up to the present, I been buying my own and have my own.
Have you been very successful as an owner? You just bought horses, and did you train your own horses?
Yeah, I trained my own. And it was almost next to impossible to go public or to train horses for other people because of my hours. As a trainer, owners want you there all of the time, okay? But I had to leave every morning at 7:30 to go to school,
cool,
because I was teaching school.
You get up in the morning pretty early,
4 o'clock every morning,
4
to get up, leave the house at 4:30 to 4:45, being at the racetrack at 5, having the first set ready to go. I always had men working for me, having the first set to go. And I, at one time, I had owned up as many as 12 horses at one time. But I always had them there to get the horses out and everything. And leaving 7:30, 8 to go to school, staying at school for practice, for basketball practice, whatever, until 5:30 or so, rushing home, taking a shower, changing clothes, putting on my business suit to go to work as a steward, and then not get back home till almost 1 o'clock
at night. What track was that where you was judge, patrol judge?
Well, I was a patrol judge before I became a steward.
Where was it? What track? What was the name?
All of the tracks in Chicago. Sportsman's Maywood. Park, mm-hmm. Maywood, Washington Park, Aurora closed that mm-hmm. after that. It was Sportsman, Maywood, Washington, Harbaugh.
That's a lot of traveling, isn't it?
Yeah. Right. It was a nicely year-round job. See, I worked year-round doing that. And
so how many years did you do that, Mr. Brown?
About eight years.
Yeah. Putting in a lot of time, right?
Spending a lot of money on my own horses that were not as successful as they should have been.
Yeah, but loving it all, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Right from the very...
If you had to turn back any of that, you wouldn't want to turn back any of those. No. Those are good days. Yeah.
Good and bad.
I understand that you are... You love horses. Yeah.
Absolutely. But only the thoroughbred.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for the thoroughbred, I wouldn't have this love for the horses. Even the standardbred horses, when I was working with the harness horses, I didn't care for them.
What is it about a thoroughbred that is attractive, that draws you into? Is there something special about the thoroughbred?
You know, I don't know that I can put my hand on it. He's just altogether a different type of animal. He's so royal, and everything he does, I mean, with a good horse, he's just regal. I mean, you just can't explain it. I can't explain it why it is. I guess maybe because of birthright. Like growing up with them makes me feel about them the way that I do. Because, as I said, I can remember back at 4 years old, being around them. And that was the only kind of horse that I was ever around. But it's something about that thoroughbred.
What about African-Americans now on the racetrack? How do you see the presence of African-Americans on the racetrack now as opposed to, say, 25, 30 years ago?
Well, when I first came around, African-Americans were dominant on the racetrack. Okay, exercise riders, grooms, hot walkers, and even to some trainers. But as far as the secondary help was concerned, leaving owners and trainers alone, African-Americans were dominant. And that probably was due to the fact that that was one of the better jobs they could have during that time. When I say better jobs, I'm speaking in terms of financially. Even though they were only making $50 a week, it was still more than what city people were making. You know, non-racetrackers were making. Today, the African-American today does not want to be with horses. They feel that it's below them. And consequently, they don't care about it. You find now the biggest influx are Spanish-Americans. Are Spanish people, where that's coming from. You can't find black jockeys anymore because boys just don't want to come to the racetrack. I mean, they have a stigma against the racetrack for some reason or the other. But if they once realize that they would never go hungry, never have to ask anybody for anything, never would have to stand in a bread line or anything, because that is a trade and a business that's going to be going on forever.
That was my next question. You see, racing is going to last for a long time.
Oh, it's going to be here forever. Yeah. It's almost been here forever.
You don't see the end of the Kentucky Derby, for example.
No. Derby is flourishing more and more every year. It's gotten to the point whereby people in Europe beginning to try to buy horses and training horses to run for the Derby, to come here for the Derby, and to come here for the Breeders' Cup Series. Racing is never going to die. Never going to die.
So I guess in sum, you would
say... But we've got to re-educate the black people as far as what kind of business that they can become involved in. If we can re-educate them to the point where they know that this is a multi-billion-dollar business, they may become more interested in it.
How do you see the entrance into the business of people like MC Hammer and Barry Gordy?
I think they did it all wrong. I think they did it wrong to the extent that the first thing that they did, I'm on the outside looking in, but I've known quite a few people like this. I've known quite a few black people that came into the business that was this way. First of all, they felt that only the big name white man could be a benefit to them. And yet that same big name white man gave less than a doggone about a black man. All they wanted was the dollar. They cared nothing about his personal feelings and about his personal belief and wants and desires. All they were concerned about was the dollar. And once they abuse the dollar, then the black man is gone, okay? Now, if the black man like Hammer or anybody else that comes into the business, ever once they decide, and then we go back to slavery for this, because this was all taught during slavery time, the division between the house nigger and the field nigger. And that's, I have to say it that way because that's the way it was. And there was that distrust in between those two groups. And that same distrust exists today between us, African Americans. That same distrust is there. It hasn't been abolished. It's there. So now, once we can have a teach the black man with money that's in business and has the money to go into the business, that there are black trainers as well as white trainers, and that the black man is going to look after his interests more so than that white man, then we'll find that more black trainers will become predominant again and dominant again, okay? But until we train that black businessman, the black man with the culture and the money, it's going to be the same thing. That's how I see them now. Now,
I
said that.
I see it the same way.
Right. I said that to say that Hammer and them, whatever happened to Hammer, or whatever happens to any other, like Luster, Fred Luster, that had the Luster cream stuff, the hair stuff, mm-hmm. whatever happened to those guys, it's deserving. Because they left their race entirely to go to the white man, because they felt that only the white man could justify them and serve them.
Yeah.
And it was one of the worst things we can do.
Which is pervasive among us.
And absolutely, and that goes back to slavery. Like I said,
the tendrils of slavery still exist. It's psychological slavery.
That's right. Absolutely. So, we do it right now with jobs.
A black doctor cannot be as good as a white doctor.
Absolutely.
A black lawyer cannot plead the case as well as a white lawyer.
That mentality, I don't know how long it's going to be around, but it's around, and it's going to be here for a long time. And how are we going to eliminate it? I don't know. But the only way that we got a chance of eliminating it is through educating us and through pointing out the successful people. And if you get, for an example, that in horse racing business, and let's just take horse racing. You could get 5 guys with $10,000 to $15,000 a piece and put it in the pot. So you put in $50,000 to $75,000. And they give this money to a black guy and say, here's the amount of money that we have. Buy us the horse or the horses that we can use that can make us some money with. If they did that, then they can see. They take that same $75,000, go to a white guy. First of all, the white guy is going to count his money in, okay? And how much he's going to make out of it, and before he even thinks in terms of buying that horse. You see, so, but the black guys or the black people, the black men or whomever is involved, they don't know all of the other rudiments that go along with it. So, whatever the regimentation is on the racetrack, black people are not completely aware of it. And they will not get the black man who's there on the racetrack to run their business for them. You cannot run and operate a business if you're not there. I am not a neurosurgeon, so I wouldn't go in and tell the doctor how to operate on somebody. That same doctor shouldn't come and tell me how to train his horse. You see, and they don't do it to the white guy, but they'll pick up a condition book and they'll tell that black trainer, well, how come this horse is not running here? Next thing they know, they're taking that horse away from him and giving it to another guy. You take, but the best example is Lifelight, who was an outstanding three-year-old filly, what, 4 years ago, right. Whatever. Hammond owned this horse. He owned Dance Floor, outstanding three-year-old colt. He, the first guy that he had, it wasn't McAnally, what else was the guy named that was training Lifelight for, was very successful. But then he wanted Wayne Lucas because Wayne Lucas had the big name. He turns Lifelight over to Wayne Lucas. Wayne Lucas breaks her down. He broke her down, brought her back too quick, tried to run her, and broke her down again where she was no good. Okay? Dance Floor was running very successful. He was a three-year-old. He was running very successful against three-year-olds. All of a sudden, Lucas put him in the Metropolitan against older horses, and he got him running as a stablemate, that was a criminal type or whatever the horse was, and setting him out there as a rabbit, breaks him down. They don't care. Right. They don't care. Mismanagement. Lifelight could have made so much money just by running against fillies instead of running against boys. They carried her down there and ran in the Super Derby, yeah, which they had no business. Right. On television, Ham was bad in them. Oh, we're going to be in the Belmont. Why the heck would you think in terms of trying to run her in the Belmont? You got all of them three-year-old filly races that you can run in and make millions of dollars.
So, in other words, you see them as like flashes in the pan.
Right.
But if someone were really to get interested, how do you view sales and breeding and all that? Have blacks ever been involved at that level in the horse racing?
Yeah. Yes, they have. In fact, all of my horses I buy to sell. I buy every horse that I own. Well, I used to buy them all privately, but then I would go to the sale. Like right now, I have a two-year-old. I call it falling through the cracks. If you go to the sale and you study pedigree and you inspect all of the horses that they have, I mean, you can't inspect them all, but you just get certain bloodlines that you want to have. You look at all those bloodlines, and then you go inspect those horses that are in that category. And then you can set prices on them. If they're going to be out of your price range, then you go look at more, and so on. But at every sale, there is a horse or a couple of horses that fall through the crack. And I say fall through the crack, I mean this. There are horses that come into the sale ring that should sell for $100,000 or more, or $75,000, say $75,000 and up. But for some reason, for whatever that reason is, one of those horses will fall through the crack and sell for $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. Okay? Now, if you know pedigree, and you're there, and you have inspected that horse, or whatever, if you're there, you can get that horse. Now, you can come out of there with a $100,000 sales animal that you may have paid $10,000, $12,000, $13,000, $15,000 for, because that horse fell through the crack. Now, I own one. I just bought one at the last year's yearling sale that fell through the crack. A horse that should have sold up in the just over $100,000 or more.
Who was the father?
The father of this horse is Imperial Falcon. Now, Imperial Falcon does not have any outstanding race record. He only raced three times in his life, and they were overseas. But Imperial Falcon is by Northern Dance out of Belize. Imperial Falcon is the third highest yearling ever sold in America. He sold for over $5 million as a yearling in America. He's the third highest yearling ever sold. He's only had four crops come to the races. But I didn't buy this horse because of Imperial Falcon. And although Imperial Falcon's a half-brother to Devil's Bag, he's a half-brother to Rahe and those horses. But I bought him because of his mama, his mama's side. And as when I first came around the racetrack, the old timers used to always say, it's the titty that you suck that counts, son. Don't ever forget that. So his mother, this Imperial Falcon coat that I bought. It's out of a stakeswoman in there. She's had six other foals, five of them to race, all five of them are winners, and two of them were stake winners. She, and she's by Grostock, she in turn is either a full or half-sister to eight other stake winners that her mother had. Her mother was a stakes winner by Tom Fool and had 14 foals, and eight of them, she was full or half-sister, seven, because she was the eighth one. Eight of the 14 are stakes winners. Wow. You understand that? She's a full sister to a horse named Jim French, which won the Santa Anita Derby, finished second in the Kentucky, finished second in the Belmont, a horse named Bill Bonbright, who won 23 races. You know, I mean, tremendous family.
So this horse that you got now, is that a 2-year-old or 3-year-old?
He's two.
2 years.
He's a late foal and May foal, and he's 16-3 now. No, I had to put him back because he's just growing so fast and so big that I couldn't do anything with him. Now he still hasn't gotten it all together. You know, I have him here, but he's going back home with me when the season is over, when Churchill season is over, around Thanksgiving time, end of the month, take him back and turn him out for another 30 days, and try to pick him up again at the first of the year, and see how well he's along then, to see what happened with him.
So you're a student.
I expect
a student of breeding. Right?
You have to look to really understand the game of thoroughbred racing. You should know something about pedigree, about bloodline, because then you can tell basically whether or not this horse is going to be a sprinter, whether or not this horse is going to be a round horse, whether or not he has any black type in his family, how much black type he's going to have in his family, and you can get a real idea as to what kind of horse you are supposed to have when you go to the sales and buy. And as the old saying says, you're not hardly going to improve on no claimer. You know, what you claim is what you got. You buy a $5,000 horse, that's what you're going to have. You go to the yearling sale and buy a yearling, the old timers just say it's like buying a pig in the poke. You don't know what's going to come out of there.
But you have a lot to say about what might come out of it.
But what comes is by pedigree.
If you've got the pedigree and the configuration and all the things that go with making a good racehorse, you see the legs and you see the configuration and you got the pedigree, the chances are if you train that horse and you're the one that breaks them and trains them and all that, that you might be better off that way, going that route than just going up claiming horses.
Right, but I wouldn't take a client, a new client, coming into the business and go to the yearling sales with them. I would claim a horse for them. I would try to claim the most expensive horse that I could for them.
And
because,
let them see them win?
Right, let them see the horses run.
Yeah.
And if they had X number of dollars where they could invest on the side, then get a yearling and try to go that route. But them coming into the business, they need a horse to run.
Yearling, because they don't understand
it. They need a horse to run.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to keep them interested.
Right.
Just go to the races and see their colors run and try to see that horse get on that finish line first. And it's something to help them to supplement the money that they are spending to pay those daily bills.
Yeah.
You know.
So with the clock here now, 65. I'll be 65 next week, so I know what it is. At 65 now, you're probably winding down your career. You retired from the school system, right?
Yeah.
Two years ago. You never retired from horse racing, all right?
No, take horse races from me and you might as well put me in a hole and cover me up.
Well, it's been good talking to you, brother. Mr. Clark, I'll tell you, is there anything that you would like to say before we wind up this interview about horse racing in general? A few last words.
Yes, I would like to say this, and this is pertaining to you. I don't really know what your full capacity is in job-wise, I'm speaking of, but somehow or the other, you need to address the young blacks in this city first before going any further and getting them interested in the horse business. Even if you have to take them to some established trainers and get them jobs working from the ground level up so that they can, the ideal thing is to get a school, to get some kind of horse school for them, and where you can take some of the underprivileged black kids in the city or from wherever they come from. If you could get some kind of funding to start a school and have astute horsemen run the school. I mean, not just people off of the street, but astute horsemen to run the school that can teach these kids something and have access to horses where they can learn grooming and training, and then most of the most important, the paperwork that is, goes along with it, and the doctrine of these horses. The doctrine that they can do themselves without having to call a vet. I'm not talking about using any needles and any kind of injectables that they have to do, but everything else that they have to do, so they can get a thorough understanding from the ground up about horse business, and maybe that way we can get more blacks into the game and better blacks into the game.
I've had the idea, and maybe that's a route that I will take. As I go through and as I wind down my career at the university now, I think that's a very good one.
Yeah, and I don't know how much money has to be involved. It may not have to be a lot of money, but I know that there's funding around for mostly anything that you want to do. And if somebody writes a proposal and presents it to somebody, either the federal government or the state government.
We're talking about an occupation that is everlasting.
That's right. And at the same time, if you can get like some kind of little funding for them while they're going to school, keep them more interested. And it gives them something they got.